Berlin Calling. Berlin Calling, the American mothers rise from Tinkerab. And I'd just like to say, girls, that when Berlin calls, it pays to listen. When Berlin calls, it pays to listen in. Because there's an American girl sitting at the microphone every Tuesday evening at the same time with a few words of truth to her country's women back home. Girls, you all know, of course, by now that it's a very serious situation, and there must be some reason for my being here in Berlin. Some reason why I'm not sitting at home with you at the little sewing bees, knitting socks for our men over in French North Africa. Yes, girls, there is a reason, and it's this. It's because I'm not on the side of President Roosevelt. I'm not on the side of Roosevelt and his Jewish friends and his British friends. Because I've been brought up to be a 100% American girl, conscious of everything American, conscious of her friends, conscious of her enemies. And the enemies are precisely those people who are fighting against Germany today, and in case you don't know it, indirectly against America too. Because a defeat for Germany would mean a defeat for America. Believe me, it would be the very beginning of the end of America and all of her civilization. And that's why, girls, I'm staying over here and having these little heart-to-heart talks with you once a week. I know they're awfully short, and there's not much that one can say. But at least I'm so convinced that it's the truth, and I'm sure that truth will win. Gee, girls, isn't it a darn shame? All the sweet old American summer atmosphere which the boys are missing now. Just imagine sitting out on the old back porch in a sweet old rocking chair, and listening to the birds at twilight. Instead of that, the boys are over there in the hot, sunny desert, longing for home, and for what? Fighting for our friends. Well, 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 since when are the British our friends? Now, girls, come on, be honest. As one American to another, do you love the British? Well, of course, the answer is no. Do the British love us? Well, I should say not. But we're fighting for them. We're shedding our good young blood for this kike war, for this British war. Oh, girls, why don't you wake up? Oh, after all, the women can do something, can't they? Well, we'll try to realize where the situation is leading us to. Because it could lead our whole civilization if it goes on like that. After all, let the British get out of their own mess, girls. And let God save the king. If he's worthy of it, I'm sure God can. At least there's no reason for we Americans to get mixed up in British messes. Don't you agree with me? Well, girls, I'm sorry, but the time is really nearly up now. And just in closing, girls, I'd like to ask you one question on the level, straight from the shoulder. If your child behaves badly, do you agree with its misbehavior? Do you say to yourself, my child, right or wrong, I don't care what he does? No, you don't. You try to correct that child. You try to make him a better citizen. Well, and what is a country? A country is only made up of people, after all. Do you say, my country, right or wrong? No, girl. That's false sentimentality. And I do not say my country, right or wrong. I love America. But I do not love Roosevelt and all of his kite boyfriends who have thrown us into this awful turmoil. And I'll stick to my guns as long as I can fire them, girl. So you've not heard the last of me, and I'm sure that you'll not switch off your radio because you will want to hear more of what Berlin is saying through the medium of an American girl. And do you remember when you were a little girl, perhaps? And your father gave you a beating. Well, I mean, it did happen sometimes, didn't it? But not so very hard. And then father said to you, this hurts me more than it does you. Well, I remember father saying that to me once. And I looked up into his eyes when he said, this hurts me more than it does you. And I thought he was an awful person. But daddy only did it for my good. And girls, that's why I'm making life much harder for me than I need to make it by staying over here in Berlin and trying to give you the truth straight from my heart. Girls, watch out. Become America conscious. Don't forget the beautiful things we have at home, which are now in danger of being jeopardized by the Jewish and the British. Gedeichten.
Germany calling. Germany calling. Here are the right sender ambush. Station Bremen and station DXB on the 31-meter band.
Welcome to Radio Albion. Toilet Over England, Chapter 6 by William Joyce. First you heard a recording by Mildred Elizabeth Gillars, born November 29, 1900, died June 25, 1988. Her alias was Axis Sally. Wiki states, in 1929 Gillars left the US for France, where she worked as an artist model in Paris. In 1933 she left the US again, residing first in Algiers, where she found work as a dressmaker's assistant. In 1934 she moved to Dresden, Germany to study music, later being employed as a teacher of English at the Berlitz School of Languages in Berlin. In 1940 she obtained work as an announcer with the Reichsrundfunk Gesellschaft, RRG, German State Radio. By 1941, as the US State Department was counseling American nationals to return home, Gillars chose to stay in Germany after her fiancé, a naturalized German citizen named Paul Carlson, said that he would never marry her if she returned to the United States. Shortly afterwards, Carlson was sent to the Eastern Front, where he died in action. Mildred Gillars' last broadcast was on 6th of May 1945, just 2 days before the German surrender. Gillars was indicted on September 10, 1948, and charged with 10 counts of treason, but only 8 were proceeded with at her trial, which began on January 25, 1949. The prosecution relied on the large number of her programs recorded by the Federal Communications Commission stationed in Silver Hill, Maryland, to show her active participation in propaganda activities against the United States. It was also shown that she had made an oath of allegiance to Hitler. On March 10, 1949, the jury convicted Gillars on just one count of treason, that of making the Vision of Invasion broadcast. For this count alone, she was sentenced to 10 to 30 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. In 1950, a federal appeals court upheld the sentence. Gillars served her sentence at the Federal Reformatory for Women in Alderson, West Virginia. She became eligible for parole in 1959, but did not apply until 1961. She was released on June 10, 1961. Mildred Gillars died at Grant Medical Center in Columbus in 1988, diagnosed with colon cancer. Her grave in Holy Family Section, Random Selection Lot 570 of the St. Joseph Cemetery in Lockburn, Franklin County, Ohio, is unmarked. Now we shall go on to Chapter 6 of Twilight Over Albion by William Joyce. Chapter 6, The Jews. This chapter had better begin with the intelligent criticism of the Jewish race by one of its own illustrious members, Israel Zangwill. Pious fanatical zealots, throttled by Talmud coil, impious, lecherous skeptics, cynical stalkers of spoil, wedded neath Hebrew awning, buried neath Hebrew sod, between not a dream of duty, never a glimpse of God. Blarneying, shivering, crawling, taking all colours and none, lying, a fox in the covert, leaping an ape in the sun. After this verdict, nothing that I have to write on the subject will seem too strong. It is characteristic, indeed, of the Jewish superiority complex to make such a brazen admission of Jewish faults. And first of all, we must consider the Jewish character. It must not, moreover, be considered in relation to race and not religion. Whether the Jew is Orthodox, atheist or Christian, he remains a Jew. If he is Orthodox, the path of his dishonesty may be slightly more predictable. When a Jew asks you to consider his case on religious grounds, he is merely trying to play on your sympathy and using his faith for the same purpose as the Kol Nidri, that is to say, the solemn forswearing of all vows that may be given in the year to come. Thus, it is not proposed to examine here the question as how far the Jewish religion may have influenced Jewish character. Those who accept the Old Testament as an authority will, if honest, come to the conclusion that no form of religion could be revealed to the Jews which they would not forthwith debase into materialism of the grossest order. As Dryden says, they were a moody, headstrong, murmuring race has ever trod the extent and stretch of grace. Adamantine materialism, a flair for assuming mysticism outwardly, a supreme contempt for other races, a complete disregard for other people's rights, cleverness in imitation and improvisation, contempt for all labour not associated with high profits, great energy in the course of money-making, a hatred of all nationalism but their own, a high degree of loyalty to their own family and their own community, an implicit faith in the power to corrupt Gentiles, a brilliant capacity for intrigue, and a pathetic inability to keep pace with any deeper thought or higher idealism are the chief characteristics of the Jewish race. On all these attributes, volumes could be written, but it should suffice to express the result of these forces very simply in the following tendencies. An incapacity to avoid forming a state within a state. Complete inability to view their Gentile hosts as possessing equal rights with their own. Predetermined specialisation in all those processes which bring high profit, hence, in capitalism, almost exclusive preoccupation with finance, distribution, and exchange as distinct from productive industry, professional work undertaken either for profit or for the sake of social advancement, a natural tendency to utilise social and economic advancement for the purpose of gaining political power, an unholy dread of nationalism as a factor which would draw attention to their racial nature and expose their operations, the deliberate debasements of the standards of culture in the land of their sojourn, the elimination by competition of the Aryan who merely wants to get his enough for himself and not more than anybody else. These resultants seem to manifest themselves in every land that the Jew inhabits. There can be no doubt that he is a hard worker, where there is profit to be made. The German or the Englishman may think, well, now I have done my day's work and I can settle down to a little enjoyment. Not so the Jew. His only form of enjoyment is the gaining of power. Whilst the white man works to enjoy something of life, the Jew works to become the master of his environment. When others are drinking their beer and chatting idly, he is cynically staking his spoil. This is perhaps one of his worst characteristics. I make no plea for laziness, but the thought that a man cannot settle down to enjoy some pleasure in his life without having to reckon with the ever-vigilant Hebrew is a horrible thought indeed. Such a state of affairs means that all culture, all enjoyment, must give way to the ruthless pursuit of profit and pelf. This factor has contributed more than is generally realised to the unpopularity of the Jewish race. The Jew who reads this passage would probably exclaim, "Ha ha, I was right. They was jealous of the work us boys can do." This misunderstanding is typically Hebrew and relates to the purpose of life itself. If a Jewish coal miner, could such a thing be found, decided to work 2 hours extra a day, nobody could have any objection, except a narrow-minded trade union official. But it is not in honest production that the Jews work overtime. It is always in some calling which enables profits to be made at the expense of others. Just as the tendency to this form of competition arouses antagonism, so an even greater hostility is aroused by the natural Jewish practice of installing one's friends and relations in all accessible places of vantage. Where Moses comes today, Raquel comes tomorrow, and a day after tomorrow there will arrive Isaac, Nathan, Benjamin, Reuben, Hyman, Levi, Hethor, Solomon, Isidore, and Samuel, with poor old Aaron panting in the rear, Talmud under his arm. Give them a few months and nothing short of a wholesale persecution can root them out unless, of course, a monetary revolution takes place, in which case the fraternity will start to dwindle as mysteriously as it appeared. Extreme poverty would have the same result, but the process of dwindling would not begin so long as a single Aryan was left to pluck. As an illustration of the odious character of this race, I would quote the case of a Jewish student whom I once compelled to teach. He had won the second scholarship awarded by a medical school in London. He was in tears. I asked him what was the matter with him. He replied that he was disappointed because he had not come first. Such an attitude is not only fully unhealthy, but so far out of keeping with the character of the Teutonic races that it is extremely difficult to see how there can ever be an abiding peace between them and the Jews, except for the exclusion or disappearance of the latter. The communal spirit, the energy, the materialism of the Hebrews, their system of family education, The laws prescribed both by the Talmud and their spoken tradition with regard to the treatment of the non-Jew have rendered it inevitable that there should accumulate a vast stock of the commodity called money. It is only a superficial critic who opposes that they value money for its own sake. They are not mean if they often save carefully and count their pennies. It is only because every Jew sees in cash the only means of power. If the expenditure of £40,000 on a hospital buys a knighthood and a seat on the board of governors from which the appointment of other Jews to the staff can be suggested, the money is not begrudged. If a Jew decides to entertain socially, he usually does so on a lavish scale. If a Jew gains the entire entry to a country house and perceives that the estate is declining for lack of funds, he is quite likely to offer a loan without any stipulation as to repayment. Later his son or daughter marries into the family, Nathan Clausenberg becomes Sir Nathan Clavering, country gentleman, and the loan is repaid by shares in the English Aristocracy Limited. If only the Hebrew would use his pelf like a vulgar merchant, he would be easier to tolerate. Instead, he employs it to permeate into every stratum of society, carrying with his racial consciousness, his racial character, his racial purpose, and his monstrous materialism. In this way, it has come about that a very large number of the so-called aristocratic families of Britain are impregnated with Oriental blood. At the polite and select dinner table, it is never safe to discuss the Jews, because the family plate has probably been presented by the latest Jewish brother-in-law. I remember one young English gentleman with a very ancient name who said to me one day, "I say, I hate the Jews, don't you?" I replied in the affirmative. He said, "Yes, and the worst of it is that I can't talk about it at home because my sister's married one of the beasts. The poor young man, if not already dead, is now in the armed forces of the Crown, fighting a Jewish battle." This resentment of the creeping by Judah even into the family bed is deeply resented at heart. But the English aristocracy is both poor and demoralised. It has had to suffer so much that it is thankful to anybody who will give it a tip. The Jews, of course, have no more interest in developing estates than in bacon curing. They are merely delighted to become masters of foxhounds and justices of the peace, thereby extending their scope of corruption. For corruption it is. It is a corruption designed to achieve a racial dominion all the more objectionable because it has neither a local habitation nor a name. A few years ago it was a sin to mention the word Jew in British society. Fortunately the position has changed. The Hebrews are mentioned freely enough and a day of reckoning is being prepared for them by the working classes, who have at last begun to identify their real rulers. The poorer a man is, the better his chance of being anti-Jewish. He has nothing material to lose. If the rich attack the Jews, they may expect the sort of treatment meted out to Henry Ford, when he had to withdraw the famous articles in the Dearborn Independent. Any British fascist who was working for a Jewish firm was dismissed as soon as his views were known. Such dismissals were not unnatural, but they served to show the power which the Jew can exercise in countries which grant him hospitality. So long as the idea of nationalism arising from blood and inherited tradition persists on this earth, the Jew can never be anything but an antisocial animal until and unless he is segregated. He can never settle down in equilibrium in Western society. He can never be satisfied with a fixed share in the state. A Jew is either extending his influence or waiting for the undertaker, and if he does the latter, he probably asks for demurrage. The unbearable attributes of the Jews were recognised in the 13th century by that great English king, Edward I. He expelled the lot. Gradually they began to creep back in again, but were not admitted with a flourish until Cromwell's time. Puritanism, breathing the quintessence of the Old Testament, was admirably suited to their needs. It served as a most useful suggestion of a community of interest between them and their hosts, and it also disposed men towards that materialism which the Hebrews so thoroughly understood and knew how to exploit. Gradually the stories of Hugh of Lincoln faded out of the national consciousness, and the Jews became a grand old people who gave us our religion. Again and again the leading prelates of the Church of England have made this statement during recent years. So purblind are these ecclesiastical leaders that they do not see the humorous implication of their aphorism. Yet it is fairly obvious that if the Jews had valued Christianity highly, they would not have made a free present of it to the Church of England. Sometimes when I have seen some fat bishop waddling along, I have recorded statements and assertions to the effect that the Jews gave was Christianity. And without pondering on the merits of the case, I've pictured the old devil dividing garments at dusk on Calvary. During the 19th century, Jewish money power was in the ascendant, and has been previously explained. Its doctrines found a very receptive body of opinion in England. As early as the Battle of Waterloo, the Rothschilds were exercising a decisive influence on the finance of the city. Throughout the century, their power increased, and, in the end, their country estates at Tring became the second seat of British government. It is, however, a great mistake to suppose that Jewish interests in Britain are limited to the realms of finance. There, of course, they are supreme. They do not hold many bank directorships, but they do determine the price of gold. They do control the lending operations of the city, and such interests as those of the Rothschilds and the Sassoons are sufficiently powerful to smash the banks under the present system. A threat to call in loans or to withdraw deposits can work wonders. Such threats often have been made. A more subtle influence can be exercised by the manipulation of stocks in such a fashion as to cause the greatest anxiety to banking houses and investors alike. Naturally, it would be possible to write many volumes on the subject of the various methods of crime peculiar to the City of London and similar institutions. It is only necessary, however, for the reader to appreciate the fact that when millions start moving en masse, they can derange any delicately balanced system of finance. The Jews are well aware of this fact and have always made use of it. Moreover, their brothers and cousins, their uncles and aunts abroad, are always willing to help them. Thus, in an unrestricted capitalist state of affairs, there is no difficulty in transferring money from one country to another, nor is there any feature of Jewish activity more constant than the close cooperation of Hebrews in different lands. Indeed, it is the possibility of this cooperation and its cash value that renders the Jews so violently opposed to nationalism. They take the whole of the world to be their province, as long as they are allowed to do so. In this fashion, they have been able to fortify themselves against the collapse of the market in any one particular country, the Schiffs, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, the Sassoons, the Ellermans, the Guggenheimers, the Castles, regard themselves as international princes. For them, the emergence of economic nationalism implies a fatal restriction on their operations. Today, however, as above suggested, the territory of the Jew extends far beyond the bounds of impure finance in England. Emboldened by his success in this field, he has advanced to conquer distributive trades and those branches of commerce most closely connected with the provision of the people's most vital needs. He has also invaded with overwhelming success the regions of film and press. In fact, it should be of interest to note briefly the extent of the Jewish conquest in the provision trade, the furnishing trade, the clothing trade, the retailing of household goods, the chemical industry, the oil and petrol trade, housing, the press, the cinema, and finally the professions. The Jewish power in England is all the more formidable because, until lately at least, it has been so carefully masked and kept in an obscurity which, if not decent, was effective. Now, however, it is possible by observing the above-mentioned categories to dispel the illusion that the Jew is merely a patient old Shylock waiting in his dingy city office to lend money to any Bassanio who can find an Antonio to guarantee the necessary pound of flesh. Merchant of Venice. Had the Jew remained in that position, he would be merely a commensurable pest. As it is, he has become an inescapable presence, an odious approximation, a haunting conscience, a shadow lengthening in noontide of your prosperity, the ounce of sour in the pound of sweet, the fly in your ointment, and the death's head at your banquet. In the provision and catering trade, the best-known firm in Britain is that of Messrs. John Lyons. Who John Lyons was and what became of him must be a matter for lengthy research than I can afford, but the actual proprietors are as Jewish as anything that ever entered a synagogue. The great chiefs rejoice in the names of Salmon and Gluckstein. Perhaps the most important of their number is Sir Isidore Salmon, Member of Parliament, who was discovered by the former Jewish war minister, Hora Balisha, to be the one man best qualified to take charge of the catering arrangements of the British Army. The tobacco retailing firm of Salmon and Gluckstein is only one of the subsidiaries of John Lyons. This latter firm has its branches in every town of any importance in Britain. The first stage of success was its gradual elimination of the small British tea shops, which could not compete with the power of massed capital and the favourable wholesale terms which Salem and Gluckstein had at their disposal. Then the scope of operations was extended to cover every kind of grocery and even meat. By scientific undercutting, the firm has managed to drive thousands of small traders into the bankruptcy courts. John Lyons is not only a Jewish firm interested in groceries. The great Unilever combine, with a total capital of more than £250 million, embracing Lever's Mac Fisheries, Lipston Sainsbury's, Herman Colonial, Maypole Dairies, and many similar concerns, is under Jewish control. Just pause there. I did mention in the last reading, which was chapter 5, that nowadays Britain is dominated by the big three supermarkets, Asda being of the Walmart group, and then Sainsbury's and Tesco, who are both owned by Jewish lords. And you see now in in Joyce's book in 1940, he mentions Sainsbury's. Continue. Amongst the names to be found on the list of directors are such good old English patronymics as Jurgens, Schicht, Hartog, Roykens, and Vandenberg. The altruistic interest of these people in providing England with food and soap is marvellous. The whole organisation is riddled with Jews. For example, the chairman of Home and Colonial is Sir George Schuster, a member of one of the most influential Hebrew families. He also finds time to act as chairman of Maypole Dairies. Another subsidiary, the African and Eastern Corporation, dealing in margarine and soap, is Lieutenant Colonel Beddington, another Jew. Beddington is related by marriage to the wealthy Burhans family, which has a large interest in a chain of tailors, Montague Burton Limited. On inspecting records in 1936, I found that among the prominent shareholders of the Unilever combine were the Prudential Trust Corporation, Midland Bank, Barclays Bank, Mutual Insurance Co., Scottish Life Insurance, Alliance Insurance Co., and Heaven Help Us, British Widows Assurance. Just pause again. British listeners will recognise a lot of those names, such as Prudential, Alliance Assurance, and British Widows has been used. I think they called it Scottish Widows, but basically what Joyce is saying, it all makes sense. It all concludes what we see today. Continue. If then anybody asks what connection banking and insurance have with Jewish interest, here is the answer. As between Lyons and Unilever, all is neatly planned, so that there is no destructive competition. But it is fantastic to suppose that the small shopkeeper could compete for very long with gigantic sales machines of this order. Once, however, the small man is completely eliminated, the public will be entirely in grip of the big Jewish purveyors. When allowance is made for the fact that not only banks and insurance companies have hitched their wagons to the Star of Zion, but that also a very large number of members of Parliament have done likewise, it is easy to see why no remedial legislation can be expected against any abuses which the victorious merchant princes may care to commit. In London, Jewish control of public houses is on the increase, and the firm of Levi and Franks competes successfully with those taverns where the workman was in the habit of going for his joint and two veg, in quotes. As yet, the development is only incipient, but it will proceed apace. The furnishing trade has been going over to Judah for many years. A large part of the cabinet-making trade in London, Manchester and elsewhere is in Jewish hands. In the East End of London, the proportion of Jewish control is not less than 80%. Meanwhile, the great hire purchase firms get rid of the furniture, whether made by sweated labour in the slums or not. These firms spend thousands a week on advertisement. Smart Ross Limited, the best known, probably spends thousands a day in popularising its wares by displaying in the press the various anatomical attitudes of a voluptuous young lady who is clad only in such places as are intended to arouse the curiosity of the male or lesbian beholder. Mr. Horbalisha was chairman of this firm until his presence in the cabinet proved to be indispensable. Compelled by his acceptance of office to resign his chairmanship, he left his interest in the faithful hands of Messrs. Teller, Lyons and Goldberg, who still traded under the name of Smart, despite the fact their promoted colleague could no longer act as chief shop walker. Smart they certainly are. These hire purchase firms employ, without scruple, all the devices of cell psychology to make the poor pledge themselves to exorbitant undertakings. In this respect, Smarts are no worse than the other Jewish firms, such as Bolson's, Blunder's, Wolf and Hollander, Jay's, and Drudge's. You may ask why they should aim at establishing debts which cannot be liquidated. The answer is that the real strategic aim is to establish a loan on the greater proportion of the workers' wages. The nominal price of the goods is always far in excess of its ordinarily cash retail worth, so it is on about credit. After a time, when instalments begin to lapse, a representative calls and threatens court proceedings. The woman of the house is dismayed. £1 a month did not seem much to pay for the radio. 2 shillings a week for some blankets from Blundell's seemed only a trifle. Half a crown a week was evidently very cheap for the front room suit which Mrs. Smarts presented upon her, and then nobody could say that 10 shillings a month for a piano represented greed on Sir Benjamin Drake's part. Still, with all the tallymen came at once and threatened to see her husband, it was hard to know what to do. One tallyman, kinder than the rest, says that he will consult his directors. If she places a further order to the value of only a shilling a week and pays just a little on account, say, 2 bob, ma'am, county court proceedings can be avoided. Times will improve, ma'am. So she pays the blood money and gives the tallyman a cup of tea. Relaxing and patting the little daughter on the head, he admires her fair hair and then talks about his own children. Unless he gets so many new orders, he explains, each week, he will get the sack. His employers are Yids. He is very sorry indeed that the good woman has so much trouble, but we all must live. Thankfully draining his tea and promising to come without fail on the following Monday, he goes 10 yards down the street and repeats the process. The noble directors do not mind. They are philosophers, and they reflect that one cannot get all that one asks. The next best thing is to get as much as possible. No good businessman can hope to secure more than a legal loan on the workers' wages. If the furniture has to be confiscated because the instalments lapse, there is an army of Jewish polishers waiting to restore its lost youth preparatory to resale. If the damage is too far gone, well, there is always antique shops, isn't there? Solly. Such was the scandal of hard purchase that not long ago Miss Ellen Wilkinson delivered a slashing attack in the House of Commons upon its methods. Little will come of her efforts. It is the whole nature of the system and its appeal that needs correction, not minor details or injustices. Sometimes the process is merely one of money lending. Goods are taken by the very poor and pawned. I once saw a tallyman handing a pawn ticket by a woman who had not been able to redeem the goods in time. He kept it as security, well knowing that the day of reckoning must come. The pawnbroker could be compelled to part with the goods at any time. The wretched woman, however, was accumulating a double debt. So much detail has been devoted to this one small aspect of Jewish business because it is typical of the whole and true to historic type. A number of these firms deal in clothes as well as furniture. Some add coal to the list. With these perishable or consumable goods, the tallyman must be more watchful. Here the arts of intimidation have to be practiced with skill. I know of one firm of this character which sent out a very official-looking final demand on portentous blue paper, the exact size of a summons, headed with the legend, in Gothic type, County Court. Many ignorant people must have supposed that the law had been actually invoked against them. Where it is invoked, of course, the defendant must pay costs, often exceeding the amount of the debt. Failure to pay the sum stipulated by the court may lead to committal to prison for an indefinite period. It is very interesting to ask whether the suspense and fear which hundreds of thousands of people in Britain are kept by these methods of trading are regarded by Parliament as evidence of the British love of freedom. Debt, the fear of unemployment or sickness and its economic results, the constant struggle to pay what cannot be found, are the main features of the democratic freedom which the majority of English people support. Let us now turn to the clothing trade. The conditions which prevailed in the Jewish sweatshops of East London and Manchester, to say nothing of Leeds, demanded parliamentary legislation early in this century. However, experience shows that there is no form of parliamentary legislation which the Jews cannot circumvent. Everybody acquainted with the Yorkshire woollen industry knows exactly how the Jews entrenched themselves. Thus, in Leeds today, there is a Hebrew population of approximately 50,000. In consequence of this mighty efforts, it was possible for Jewish tailors to establish chain stores all over the country. The most notorious firm so set up that of Montague Burton. whence the Montague came in another unsolved mystery. But Maurice and Bernard Burton are registered at Somerset House as Russians. They are no more Russian than your author is a Chinaman. They are Jews of the first and last water. Formerly they were called Orbach, but still earlier times they must have had a more biblical name. As early as 1935, they had 500 branches in Britain and 364 other retail shops through Key Estates Limited. The list of directors is not exactly Anglo-Saxon. It contains the names of Lord Greenwood, Hamar Grunwald, David Olinsky, Ellis Hurwitz, Baranich Flusoff, Beddington Behrens, and of course Maurice and Bernard. These persons have pursued an eminently successful war against a small British tailor and have, quite naturally, gained a number of contracts for the fighting forces. To make everything quite respectable, however, the chief clothing advisor to the British forces of the Crown is one Sir Philip Marquess. He is not yet entitled to sport strawberry leaves, but he is a Jewish gentleman of considerable initiative, and it is not too much to hope that one day he may become Lord Burton of Trent. At any rate, in choosing the purveyors of food and clothes to the services, Mr. Belisha could scarcely be accused of disloyalty to his own people. These Jewish tailors are cordially hated by the British members of the trade, but, once again, heavy capital and good wholesale terms are decisive. It is a weak-minded Jewish tailor who cannot work his way, by a series of fires, from Whitechapel to Regent Street. I once saw a little Jewish shop being cleared of nearly all its stock. Gown after gown was tucked away in one car after another. 15 minutes later the place was on fire, and all the stock was destroyed. Curiously enough, when I saw the said gowns being loaded into the cars, I had a strong temptation to ring up the fire station. The more astute Jewish businessman is usually a little nervous about the fire brigade. One wealthy Jewish merchant in Richmond, Surrey, even went so far as to provide the fire brigade with accommodation between 2 and 3 miles outside of the town. The rural environment was good for the firemen, far better than the noisy urban surroundings which they had hitherto been obliged to support in Richmond. There can be no doubt that the longer ride to work was just as good for the firemen as it was bad for the insurance companies. From their country seat, the members of the brigade received far more calls than they had received in town. The reason for this phenomenon could probably be explained by that great expert in pyrotechnics, Leopold Harris. In the retailing of household goods, the small British trader has had to yield before the sweeping advances of Messrs. Woolworths and the firm of Marks and Spencer. In 1935, Woolworths had 628 branches in Britain, and since then the number has increased. The capital was £10 million. In 1931, N.M. Rothschild & Sons acquired 4.8 million 6% cumulative preference shares and 2.25 million ordinary shares. Amongst the chief shareholders are H.V. Beverton, Jew, for N.M. Rothschild, Asebag Montefiore, also Jewish, the Jewish Lady Baron, and Israel Moses Seif, whose race is sufficiently indicated by his name, and who is also the main proprietor of Marks and Spencer's. This latter firm is quite a menagerie. Mr. Spencer vanished long ago, but the business of the hundreds of stores belonging to the firm with a capital of more than £5 million is controlled by Israel Moses Seif, who has or had the able assurance of Luther Green, Simon Marks, Norman Lasky, Alexander Isaacs and R.F. Neuheim. The latter represents or represented the Industrial Finance and Investment Corporation Limited, whose board is honoured with the names of Lord Melcheat, the Jewish controller of Imperial Chemicals Limited, P. Lindenberg, A.I. Belisha, M. Lubick and E. Spielberg. Amongst the chief shareholders of Marks & Spencer in 1936 were the following: Prudential Insurance Company, Theo Gluckenheimer, Lewinstein & Hecht, Esther Pecht & Co., Swiss Bank Corp., Scottish National Trust, B. Isaacs, Mrs. E. Lasky, Sarah Lasky, Paul Lowy, Ephraim Marks, Rebecca Seif, B. I. Wurzman, M. Lubick. There's quite a lot more names, they're all Jewish names is the point. These data were available when I last inspected the records. By this time, the happy family ought to have grown. Attention must again be directed to the connection between this Jewish enterprise and the world of banking and insurance. It is not necessarily for Mr. Israel Moses Seif to sit on the board of the Bank of England in order to have his way. He need only wag a finger in the boardroom of Marks and Spencer's in order to make the banks tremble. Woolworths and Marks and Spencer sell all sorts of household goods, garden hoses, soap, hardware, fittings, gramophone records, as well as ice cream and cosmetics. Indeed, it is very difficult to mention any line of small business with which they do not compete. As Mr. Israel Moses Seif is on the board of both companies, there is no danger of serious competition between the two. Backed by at least £15 million capital, favoured with the best wholesale terms and unlimited credit, skilled in seeking out the cheapest labour markets of the world, they can ruin the small shopkeeper off the street. Quick note, Woolworths went bankrupt about 3 or 4, maybe a little bit more years ago. The reason was all these small sort of pound shops, you know, dollar shops, dollar a dime shop, they took over, they competed too much with Woolworths. Marks and Spencer, on the other hand, continues. Both firms are portrayed as good, wholesome, traditional British firms. And I did not know what I just learned from William Joyce that they're both owned by Jews. Continue. They employ female labour, and it is by no means uncommon in some of these stores for a girl of 18 or 19 to work 60 or 70 hours a week for very low pay. The atmosphere is usually foul, and the attendant must be on her feet all day, snatching a meal as best she can. Thus, despite the low prices charged, the profits are enormous, so that Sarah, Lena, Miriam and Rebecca do not have to think of the white shop girls who ruin their health and, not infrequently, their morals in the great task of building Jerusalem in England's green and present land. The low purchasing power of the people naturally urges them to buy as cheaply as possible, without regard to the manner in which the cheapness has been attained. A considerable part of the goods offered has been made by cheap Oriental labour, but the purchasers are not politicians. They buy what they can, and whether they ruin British traders or throw British workers out of employment is immaterial to them when they see something cheap. This is exactly the frame of mind that democracy induces, hence its invaluable utility to the Jewish exploiter. It would be possible to give other examples of this type of Hebrew enterprise, but the two instances cited should be enough. It is easy to say that the British trader should defend himself, but it is hard to see how he can do so without going to the length of revolution. In democracy, he has no means of making his opinion known, much less respected. He cannot go like Lady Seif and have a cosy chat with the royal family. Consequently, the decline of the individual trader has been very marked in recent years. Given another 10 years, the Jewish magnates could probably cause him to disappear altogether. At any rate, the struggle has been a losing one for English tradesmen, and the sad fact is that many of them have been at a loss to understand why business was so bad. Concerning the chemical industry, it is sufficient to mention the fact that the Melchi interests are predominant in imperial chemical industries, the most important chemical undertaking in Britain. Its intelligence department is somewhat better than those of the government, but naturally there is much cooperation and overlapping between the former and the latter. The present Lord Melchett had, for business reasons, been brought up as a Christian by his father, old Alfred Mond. He decided, however, a few years ago that it was fashionable to be Jewish and reverted to the faith of his fathers. The Mond interests are so widely spread that it would be impossible to trace them here. The old man, however, was mainly interested in preventing the Dead Sea salts from being developed on the basis of maximal production, and the story of how he and other Hebrews, including Leopold Amory, managed the House of Commons in order to secure that tenders and contracts should go to low producers forms a very interesting chapter on parliamentary history. The details of the swindle would require a whole new volume. In the petrol and oil industry, it is probable that Whaley Cohen and Lord Bearstead, formerly Montague, are the most powerful men in Britain today. Between them, they hold more than 100 directorships on the board of oil and petrol companies. Their interests extend from Persia to Texas. As has already been mentioned, the service of their private interests precluded the development of the oil from coal process in Great Britain, except on a quite contemptible scale. In housing too, the Jews are making an increased interest. The main Portsmouth Road is plastered with garish slogans advertising the homeless to repose their confidence in Nathan Burke. In London recently, certain blocks of flats have been adorned with the legend, "No Gentiles need apply." The Jews are certainly beginning to feel at home in their New Jerusalem. We now come to the very interesting question of the British press. In England, it is fashionable to pretend that the Jews have nothing to do with it. The Hebrew influence, however, well concealed, is very strong. Papers like the Times and Telegraph, which represent the high financial interest, are naturally dependent on the goodwill of the city. That is to say, they must give the Jews most favoured nation treatment. The Walters and the Astors of the Times are, of course, not Jewish, but their financial interests are those of Judea. Lord Camrose of the Daily Telegraph claims to be Welsh. His origin is even more obscure than his business methods, but he is certainly connected by marriage with the Rothschild family, and his chief coadjutor, Colonel Leeson, is descendant of Levi Lawson, later Lord Burnham, the founder of the paper. These two well-known journals depend, like all other British dailies, upon advertisements. The continental reader may not understand to what an extent this dependency exists in England. No big paper can pay its way on its scales with seats in Britain. Rather, it would be possible to give a whole issue away free without a second thought, provided that the advertisement revenue were satisfactory. But a great percentage of this revenue is provided by the large Jewish firms such as Lyons and Smarts. The Jewish advertiser need only threaten to withdraw his advertisements in order to cause complete panic in the boardroom of the paper in question. A good instance of the use of this power occurred with my personal knowledge in 1934. In the January of that year, Lord Rothermere, the chief proprietor of the Daily Mail, began to support Sir Edward Moseley and his British Union of Fascists. He was generous, both with his publicity and his money. Very soon, however, he began to express grave concern at the growing anti-Jewish tendency of the movement, a tendency for which I was very largely responsible. After a few months, he announced that he could support the Union no longer, unless it could be guaranteed that the movement would not be anti-Jewish and would abandon certain important parts of its policy. An open exchange of letters took place between him and Moseley, in which Lord Rothermere laid emphasis on the fact that he could not be a party to any anti-Jewish propaganda. Actually, he admitted in private that Sir Isidore Salmon had told him that continued support of the British Union of Fascists would mean the withdrawal of all Lyons advertisements from the Daily Mail, as well as any other financial inconveniences which could be arranged. Rothermere had £30 million and could have stood the struggle. His directors, however, were prepared for no such sacrifice. Especially reluctant was Mr. Scaresby, a Jew himself, to disappoint the expectations of Sir Isidore. Thus, a multi-millionaire and a man of very strong character was compelled to bow down to the Directorate of Jewry. And if he was not in position to resist, who was? Whatever opinions may be entertained concerning Moseley and his movement, there could be no graver stigma on the so-called freedom of expression said to prevail in Britain than that of a body of Englishmen should be prevented from expressing their views by an Oriental confectioner. The patient Jewish reader must not, however, suppose that we are finished at this point with the Hebrew control of Britain's press. A few names can be cited to show that much of this control is direct. First on the list comes the super-capitalist proprietor of the Socialist Daily Herald and Oldman's Press Limited. This is Lord Safewood. The Jewish yearbook for 1938 gives his early name as Julius Salter Elias. He is himself a conservative and plays a kindly part in the functions of the local conservative party in Fernhurst, where his sumptuous country mansion is situated. He seems to have every quality except poverty to conduct and control the main socialist newspaper of Great Britain. His leading shareholder is one Abraham Abrahams, who cannot trace his descendant to the Manchu dynasty. My Lord Safewood controls sources of periodicals, including, funnily enough, Sporting Life. Those journals of high society, The Tatler and The Spectator, and the Illustrated London News are also his. What a liberal-minded man it is who can depict in one paper the sufferings of the poor, and in half a dozen others the extravagant festivities of the rich. One is tempted to think that his lordship's breadth of mind is second only to his appreciation of same profits. One of his vice-chairmen is Camille Ackerman, another Jew, who is also a trustee and director of the News Chronicle. Somewhere in the background of this amusing journal there lurks a Hebrew accountant, one Hyman Binder, whose peregrinations through the Stock Exchange yearbook are so elusive as to baffle all but the most pertinacious inquirers. And Noble Julius also owns the Argus Press, a piece of pulp that he managed to salvage from the wreckage of the Morning Post. Comradely interest is taken in Illustrated Newspapers Limited by another shining light of Israel, Sir John Ellerman, son and heir of the worst ship owner that ever lived, Sir John, with the help of Israel Moses Sheaf, conducts the pornographic and pornological horrors of the Daily Mirror and the Sunday Pictorial. These wretched things exist for the purpose of stimulating hatred of Hitler and sexual activity at the same time. The truest statement ever published in them was one in which a medical expert, in quotes, informed his readers that their brains consisted of 84% water and 16% grey matter. Each number tries to surpass the former in exhibiting the pectoral and fundamental aspects of woman, and I remember one issue which published a picture of a young lady lying on a couch accompanied by a letter from the damsel in question, stating that she was so very lonely and giving her address. Of course, there is nothing that the Jews so dearly love to market as a white woman's body. Even 18 years ago, the Jewish world admitted that 75% of the white slave traffic was in Hebrew hands. Today, the percentage is probably higher. In the theatre and the film world, outside of Germany and Italy, the actress's easiest way to fame is through the bedroom of the Jewish manager. True to the Talmud, the Jew respects his own women and guards them tenderly, but his attitude towards all others is either greedily sensual or purely commercial, according to the circumstances. The managing director of the Daily Express is the veteran Jew R.D. Blumfeld, who is one of the most powerful members of the community in England. No doubt he has a hard nut to crack in Lord Beaverbrook, and it is not unlikely that they both have a share in moulding the paper's policy. Between them, then, Elias, Ellerman, Lawson, Seif, Ackerman, Skarsvazi, and Blumfeld are able to exercise a decisive and direct influence on the British press, but it must not be forgotten that if they also raised the power of advertisement revenue and the general control of finance would still be strong enough to ruin any newspaper that dared to face the Jewish question frankly. In the film industry, the Jewish control is supreme, not only in England but also in the United States. In England, the Osters and Oscar Deutsch of Odeon renown are the great magnates. The former control not only gourmet British and Fox films, but also the Baird television process, the Scoffany television companies controlled by Oscar Deutsch, Arthur Levoy, and Solomon Segel. A young actor of my acquaintance, Maurice Bradwell, took an interest in politics. For a time, he was a National Socialist. It was made clear to him that unless he renounced this interest and its accompanying activity, he need expect no more contracts for either stage or screen. He even had to write a letter to the Jewish Chronicle, disavowing what the Jew likes to call anti-Semitism. An interesting illustration of how the Jews use their control of the films is afforded by the following passage from the Sunday Dispatch of March 5, 1939. Put glory into war pictures. Hollywood gets its orders. Hark at this. Anti-war angles of the play are considerably softened and made more palatable for the masses. This is part of an American Critics review of the film Idiot's Delight. That's not really so surprising in the view of news from America that the US government has hinted to Hollywood that pacifist films are out and that death or glory pictures are to be preferred. The fact is that heads of the government don't want a great propaganda medium to be preaching peace at any price during these days of war talk all over the world. Needless to say, the great majority of the American public desired peace as heartily as anybody else in the world. What the above extract really means is that Mr. Churchill's patron, Barney Baruch, together with Brandeis, Frankfurter, Mortingdale, and the rest of the boys, gave their so racialist in Hollywood the eagerly awaited command to let slip the dogs of war. Such a candid statement could, however, hardly be expected from the Sunday Dispatch. Whilst on the subject of propaganda, we must refer, in parentheses, to the slimiest of Hebrews, Victor Golansk, who with his Left Book Club and his publishing house did as much for the cause of war as the Osters with their poisonous news films. In the professions, the gravest attack has been made on that of the doctor. Even as early as July 1935, 300 Jews from Germany had been admitted to practice medicine and surgery, and 200 to practice dentistry. Now, of course, the number must be huge. In Glasgow University alone, there are 500 Jewish students. According to the Jewish Yearbook for 1938, more than 90% of the principal teaching posts in the universities of Britain are held by Jews. But the yearbook refers only to Hebrews of the Orthodox variety. Therefore, the actual number of Jews directing higher education must be greater. Presently, we shall revert to the conditions created in England by the so-called refugees. First, however, we must contemplate a little picture drawn by Lord Beaverbrook, under the nom de plume Barnaby Rich. in the Evening Standard of May 27, 1939. There were Jews of prominence in the city, but not so many as you would expect, considering their financial ability. As for the world of society, the Jews there are not many, but they play a prominent part. The foremost Jew in London is Sir Philip Sassoon. The walls of his Park Lane home are lined with valuable pictures. Sir Philip's sister, Lady Cholmondeley, is the leading society Jewess. Sir Philip Sassoon's cousin, Mr. Edward Esmond, plays a part in racing and golfing society, both in London and in Paris. He made a fortune out of jute. Ted Esmond's surname used to be Ezra. Lord Rosebery, a half-Jew, owned the Winner. Lord Melcher has been in society but has not stayed the course because he did not wish to do so. The Rothschilds could be in society if they wanted. Lionel prefers to exercise his importance in the outer world rather than the society world. James is not in society at all. He does not like going to parties. Tony is to some extent a society figure, though seldom seen. Of the other four Jews in society, there is Mrs. Robert Lutyens, who before her marriage was called Eva Lubrovsky. She is a niece of Dr. Wiseman. Then there is Mrs. Marriott, daughter of Otto Kahn, Mrs. Venetia Montagu, and Lady Rothschild, who shine in society today, are Jewesses. They're not racially so. That means they're Khazars, fake Jews. Both have professed Jewry. Mr. Lionel Montagu is another full Jew, who is the first rate figure in society. His presence is greatly sought after for weekend parties. A new Jewish figure is emerging and going up in London society. That is the figure of Hua Balisha. He has none of the antecedents which make for success in my world, but he brings with him agreeable manners and ability. No big party in society is complete without his name. Now we've come to the half-Jews in society. First in the list are brother and sister Lord Rosebery and Lady Crewe, Sir John Fitzgerald, the 21st Knight of Kerry, is a half-Jew. Then there is Lady Louise Mountbatten, granddaughter of Sir Ernest Castle, and her sister, Mrs. Mary Ashley. Lady Beckernock is a half-Jewish. Among the quarter Jews in society are select two women as leaders. First of all, the Duchess of Roxburgh, she is Lady Crewe's daughter. Second quarter Jew on my list is Mrs. Charles Wood, daughter-in-law of Lord Halifax. Mrs. Wood's husband, Mr. Charles Wood, is a Member of Parliament for York. He is destined for success in society and in politics too. It is fair to say that the intelligence of his wife, as well the fact that he is heir to the House of Halifax, will contribute to his success. Well, I have mentioned several Jews in society. So he has this Captain Barnaby Rich, alias Beaverbrook. His little list refers only to fashionable society, with a capital S, and not to the section of the aristocracy, which holds aloof from Mayfair. His interesting catalogue gives no idea of the extent to which the older families have been permeated with the Hebrew taint, nor does he mention people on the fringe of society, like Lord Camrose, who are connected with the Jews by marriage. In every direction, the Jewish advance has been immensely strengthened by the influx of the so-called refugees. If England had started banning the worst from the German export 5 years ago, instead of in 1939, she would have saved herself the mortification of being eaten out of house and home by the new arrivals. They have been shown preference before the Englishman to an extent inconceivable to those unacquainted with the facts and comprehensible only to those who appreciate his true value, the power of Jewry in England. So great has been the indignation of certain sections of the public that even the press has had to take notice of the abuses which have arisen. The more far-seeing Jews also have been quite worried as to the danger of the reaction which the behaviour of the new army of occupation must provoke. The Sunday Express of October 23rd, 1938 wrote as follows: "There are more aliens living and working in Britain today than ever before, and every day more are landing to swell the army. In May, the last month for which figures are available at the Home Office, the number of aliens registered with the police of England and Wales alone was 196,852, over the age of 16. In addition, of course, there are thousands in Scotland and Ireland. Since these figures were compiled, there has been a big influence of Austrian refugees. We are now seeing the first wave of what may possibly a much larger influence from Czechoslovakia. It costs only £10 to become British. In 6 months this year, the total number of aliens naturalised has almost reached the number for the whole of the year 1937. How do refugee aliens make a living? Once they obtain a permit to work from the Ministry of Labour, they receive the same privileges and, incidentally, the same unemployment benefit as British subjects. aliens who can hardly speak English are now driving London taxi cabs and forcing British drivers off the streets. Cut-price gun shops are also being opened right and left by aliens. Often they start by employing British sales girls, who are later displaced by newly arrived foreigners, often disguised to get over regulations as relatives. Influential aliens do not hesitate to put pressure on British firms to employ foreigners. Dr. A. Welpley, Secretary of the Medical Practitioners Union, says, "I have investigated personally cases of threatening letters sent to doctors and hospital staffs that have been opposed to the admission of foreigners as colleagues. There have been cases of the dismissal of the British doctor without adequate explanation to make room for an alien of no better qualifications. There are hospitals now almost entirely staffed by alien doctors, domestic servants, of course, from a huge proportion of the alien army in this country." Of course, the word Jew is carefully avoided in the above passage. But of course these refugees are not safe Sea Islanders, and one can hardly expect complete frankness from the British press. Indeed, it is highly probable that no reference would be made to the invasion, were it not that silence might be constructed as complicity. Although the reader may now be growing a little wary of quotations, it is desirable to give just a few more before bringing the subject to a close. Probably the most remarkable advertisement that ever appeared in a British newspaper is the following, taken from the Times of April 5, 1939. "To Jewish refugees, businessman is prepared to finance establishment of new business or industry. Write in confidence to Box M, 132, The Times." If some good man of means had offered to set up in business British ex-servicemen who had grown tired of standing in unemployment queues, the readers of The Times would doubtless have been surprised. But this remarkable offer probably aroused little curiosity, except from the Nathans and Solomons who penned their confidential applications with kindred hopes. When one thinks, however, of all those unfortunate Englishmen who have been waiting many years for such an invitation, one does not know whether to pity them or to condemn them as idiots for their failure to grapple with the menace in their land. The Evening Standard of April 14, 1939 carried a half-page advertisement which read, "2 and 6 will keep a refugee child safe for a day. 17 and 6 will keep a refugee child safe for a week." The appeal, which had the blessing of Lord Baldwin and the Archbishop of Canterbury, did not remind the public of the fact that the child of an unemployed Englishman was supposed to be kept safe on 3/3 a week. It's old money, which I don't really understand how it works. Shillings and all that stuff. Exactly why a Jewish child should be deemed worth 6 times the value of an English child was not explained, but the valuation speaks for itself. Yep, it speaks for itself. It would be impossible to multiply almost indefinitely the examples that we have given. Space, unfortunately, does not permit. Even the revenues of the hospitals have suffered through Jewish competition, and according to the Catholic Herald of March 24, 1939, many appeals which were to have been launched for them have been abandoned, in order that nothing might interfere with the flow of cash into the pockets of the Jewish invaders. Caliph Sin, Selfridge's chief publicist, reveals that the full measure of Jewish modesty when he writes in the Times, February 24, 1939, "Germany cannot strip herself of her leading industrialists, most of whom have Jewish affiliations, without laying herself open to the gravest hurt. Let England, then, acquire what Germany is losing. Time may well prove the stone which the builders rejected to be the headstone of the corner. There is a curiously Masonic ring about this piece of impudent publicity." According, however, to the Daily Express of February 10, 1939, the National Federation of Grocers stated, "We can say without hesitation that aliens are responsible for cut price trading, and that it has increased since refugees began to reach this country in large numbers. These traders sell proprietary lines at cut prices and, having attracted customers to their shops, unload cheap and unreliable goods on the housewives of this country. The trouble is that these people often have as many as a dozen aliases. No sooner have we stopped them trading under one name than they carry on under another. On January 13, 1939, Mr. Dummett, the Bay Street magistrate, said in court, 'The system by which Jews get sailors to smuggle them into this country and then refuse to give the name of the shipboard men who got them here is a grave breach of the Aliens Act.' Mr. Metcalf, the Old Street magistrate, expressed himself on the subject in even stronger terms. 'Most of the stipendiary magistrates know that the so-called aliens are Jewish criminals of the lowest and shiftiest type, or at best, rapacious political nuisances. The resentment which is occasioned by the operations of these perfidious harpies prompted Sir Samuel Hoare to say in the House of Commons on November 21st, 1938, "In this country we are a very thickly populated industrial community with at the present a very large number of unemployed. Competition is kept with foreign countries, and it is difficult for many of our fellow countrymen to make a livelihood at all and keep their industries and businesses going. It is quite obvious that there is an underlying current of suspicion and anxiety, rightly or wrongly, on any big scale. I know from my own daily experience at the Home Office that there is the making of a definite anti-Jewish movement. I do my best as Home Secretary to stamp upon an evil of that kind. That is why I have prohibited demonstrations in certain parts of London where they would inevitably stimulate this evil movement. I may be pardoned if I choose to pay tribute to the Jewish people, the race which we know better than any other race." After delivering himself of this sickly oration, Sir Samuel could take additional pleasure in the luncheons which Sir Philip Sassoon used to give the Cabinet every Wednesday after its meeting. The most remarkable feature of his remarkable statement was the pleasure with which he announced his restriction of the liberty of His Majesty's subjects to utter their political opinions. After giving the grounds for the prohibition of this immigration, he calmly stated his intention of stamping on the British people if they dared to oppose it. His words sufficiently established the argument which this chapter was intended to develop, namely the thesis that the Jews wield tremendous power in England. For years, the government has tolerated huge communist demonstrations against itself. Police have been battered about. The Union Jack has been torn to pieces in the streets. Men have lain down on the busy streets and interrupted the traffic. Thousands of people have been allowed to assemble and pelt the fascists with stones and old iron. The House of Commons itself has been raided by the unemployed, but once let anybody of citizens try to demonstrate in their own streets against the menace of Drury, and the case is altered. All fine phrases about democratic liberty are forgotten in the twinkling of an eye. Thus it follows that the Jews have more influence than any other element in the population of Britain, and the strength which they possess is amply demonstrated by the facts given in the preceding pages. Nothing like a comprehensive survey of the whole question would have been possible in so little space, but in the view of evidence adduced, it cannot be denied that the Jewish race has the opportunity to use England as the instrument of its policy. It had, moreover, the inclination, arising not only from its feud with Germany, but from its essential opposition to the principles of National Socialism. The inclination and the opportunity must be viewed together. It must also be remembered that the Jewish conflict with Germany arose from the fundamental incompatibility between their concept of life and that of the Third Reich. They believed, and rightly, that the withdrawal of Central Europe from their system would damage irreparably that system itself. If persons of energy and tenacity be given the opportunity of executing a design arising from the strongest of motives, psychology teaches that they will execute it. The motive in this case was the destruction of National Socialist Germany, an opportunity lay in the enormous influence which they had acquired both economically and politically over Great Britain. In the press, with their firms, both with the written word and with the spoken, they pursued their design with indefatigable assiduity. The full consequences of their crime are not yet to be appreciated, but the blood of those who fall in this war is on their hands, and on the hands of the contemptible politicians whom they made their tools in this nefarious enterprise. They have deliberately set their supremacy above the peace and the welfare of the world. In their incitement to war against Germany, they have shown neither regard nor pity for the suffering and the loss of life which this conflict must cause. As they have acted, so must they be judged. Without remorse, they have worked for the death of innumerable men. It is only fitting in the circumstances that they should pay the full penalty of their unscrupulous ambition. When the clouds of war have rolled away, when the British people have been delivered up to the agonising aftermath of this final conflict, when the world can behold what ruins the crime has produced, when hungry women and homeless children stare into the greyness of the future, the architects of evil themselves shall not survive. On September 3, 1939, Britain declared war on Germany. But over and above this decree was another decree pronounced by the Supreme Court of History. It was the sentence of death upon the power, the riches, and the ambition of the Jewish race. When this sentence will be executed, no man can say, but sooner or later the most influential Jew on earth will have no more influence on the course of Aryan affairs than a jellyfish upon the time of sunrise. What the English people do not see today, they will learn by bitter experience. The German people have seen the truth already. When twilight falls on the field of battle, it is the twilight of the kingdom of Judah on earth. They have tempted God, these Jews, for the last time. That is the end of chapter 5, Toilet Over England by William Joyce. Pretty much what he says, you can just see with the benefit of hindsight, 1940 being so long ago, what he said is basically, it's carried on. If you look at Britain after the war, that we had ration books rationing for 10 years up until 1955. So even though apparently Britain won, quote unquote won, the people of who fought the war was on rations for 10 years, a whole decade after. Whereas all these names he's mentioned, who own all these businesses and all these Jews, well, they wouldn't have not been on rations, would they? Of course not. So there you go. I'll have a look at chapter 6, chapter 7, which will be in about a week's time. And chapter 7 is entitled The Empire. So I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for joining me. 14 words. Hard hit that. Take care.